Hebrew. And so right, and that violated my ethical standards, and now my parents have never repented for this. So boom, all mitzvot kibud av v'em are gone. Right? That would be pretty radical. Yes, Yehuda.
Well, maybe you're saying two separate things. One is that additionally, this violates, this is a basic principle of hating other Jews, which is actually relevant to, let's say, Maaseh Amcha. It's also second to the community, so you're also forgiven for all other things.
What?
First, there are two separate issues. One is the legal thing is not listed.
Yeah.
Secondly, since it also is not a say Maaseh Amcha, you also don't have to do kibud in other ways.
Yes, right, that's pretty radical. Because
right.
Your parents, right, the whole obligation of kibud vanishes because your parents do one wrong thing.
The second one is not necessarily. If the first argument is very strong, the second.
Yeah, you're doing the same thing as Chana. You don't really believe he means the second argument. Good, hold off. Hold off with two sources. We'll see whether he really means the second argument or not. Okay, source number 11, which I don't want to go into in depth right now, just tells you that, by the way, when it comes to finding lost objects, you're allowed to prefer your financial interests over your parents also. We have to balance that into the whole issue of Mishalav, Mishal Ben also. Let's skip to source number 12. Okay, so here is a response of the Maharik, of Yosef Kolon, asking about a question of a really important question in parent-child relations. To what degree do parents have input into children's choice of spouse? You could, one of the classic cases, we've all seen Romeo and Juliet, is when parents tell children, you're not allowed, right? I never want you to be seen with that person again. So is that the kind of command that parents have a right to issue or not? So Marik has a series of arguments. Right? He says, it seems to him that no, right? That parents have no right to issue such a command. And here is the set of arguments he makes. First of all, he says, we rule the expenses of kibud are paid by the father. Okay, good. What does it do with marriage? Now watch. All the more so here, which is something related to bodily pain, namely leaving aside the woman he desires and needing to marry a different woman who does not find as much favor in his eyes. So now marrying your second favorite choice of spouse is a cost that children are not required to bear. So that seems to suggest that the only costs that children are ever required to bear are direct financial costs. But emotional costs emotional costs are excluded from the category. Now, in order to get to that situation that emotional costs are excluded, the Marik pulls something, a really fancy equation. He says that some psychological costs are the equivalent to physical pain, and if you don't have to pay money, then obviously you don't have to undergo physical pain. So now, no physical costs, and some mental costs are at least equivalent to physical costs, particularly the mental cost of marrying your number two choice spouse. Right? That's pretty wild. And that's the strongest of the arguments Marik's going to make. Because now it's going to go further. Marik says, furthermore, he says, the matter is near in my eyes, Krovadar Beinai, that it's like he's commanding you to violate the Torah. Now, what is our new standard for violating the Torah? So our original standard was, if the Torah says, don't become to my mate, and your parent says, become to my mate, that's bad. Here's what the standard is this time. The standard is this time is that the rabbi said that a man is not allowed to marry a woman until he sees her. Which, by the way, he says we do anyway nowadays because because we live in distant parts and we can't possibly afford the expense of bringing people to see each other before they get married. But the rabbi said that you're not allowed, right? That a man is not allowed to marry a woman before seeing her. Ah, and in other places, this seems to fit a scheme which the rabbis cared about men loving their wives. And the tour and the Rush said in the previous mentioned responsum that the standard for a violation of the Torah which makes the command illegal is not a biblical violation. It's a violation of, and he has a term he has, is a nidnud of transgression. A very, very small sin. So he says, if the Rush thinks that an order is illegal if your parent tells you to hate a fellow Jew for a week, or at least to act as if you hate a fellow Jew for a week, then it seems to me that he would also think that telling you, right, that telling you to marry the woman who might not be the woman you love most is a violation of the biblical, of the rabbinic imperative to love, right, to love your wife. And therefore the order is illegal and you don't have to behave. You don't have to follow. Now, we're at a really low standard. Right? Basically anything that you think is against the spirit of Torah, you can disobey. And he's not done yet. Right? Right? These are the two arguments where the where he's building himself off explicit precedent. But now, and I think here he's building off the previous case, which says if there's your lost object and your parents' lost object, you can prefer your own. Now he makes a wildly even more radical argument. He says, furthermore, the argument as to whether the father or the son pays the expenses of kibbutz applies only to matters where the father is relevant. As, for example, the support of the father, which is necessary for the father's body and survival. But to a matter to which the father is not relevant, such as here, it is too obvious to bother saying that the father does not have the power to veto the son, neither because of kibbutz nor because of morach, because he says, look, kibbutz is only about food, morach is only about political and social position. None of this has anything to do with whom your child marries. Now, that there are two levels on which this is wild. One is he comes up with the narrowest possible definition of kibbutz nira. And secondly, as a result of that, so let's watch the moves. First, he has a really narrow definition of kibbutz nira. He formalizes that by saying that the obligations of kibbutz nira only applies to things that your parents have a direct interest in, and I would say even more sharply, they only apply to things in which your parents legitimately have a greater interest in than you do. But anything which you have a more direct or greater interest in than your parents, there is no obligation of kibbutz avim. I think it's very hard to think that he meant seriously that parents have no interest at all in whom their children marry. That's really, really hard to believe. I wouldn't want my kids to think that. And you know, because your life is very, very much determined by your relationship with your in-laws, as well. And you're right; and the happiness of your children affects you. But the Marik sets out as a principle that the obligation of kibbutz avim does not apply to things in which the child has a direct interest and the parent does not. So now you have a really strong defense. Now, what are the boundaries of that? Let's say, who has a more direct interest in whether you play computer games endlessly? Or whose life does that affect most directly? Right? What are the boundaries?
Wait, but you put legitimate in there. That would change the question.
Well, I don't know. Who has a more legitimate interest? I don't know. Right, that puts it back in teenagers, right? But what happens if, right, if we get more serious things? What if your parents really, really want you to be a doctor, right? But you want to be a social worker, right? Right. So, right. Those are, right. So, I would suggest that it tells you that or your parents really want you to be a social worker and you want to be a doctor, right? As it may, right? Whatever it may be, it seems to me that the Marik's position, which, so far as I know, has quite astonishingly become unquestioned halakha, is that the obligation of kibbutz avim is limited to circumstances where the parents have a legitimately more direct interest. If you want to take it as extreme, the extreme version is that parents have no right to talk about anything other than their direct bodily needs. That's what he says. But I'd rather take it more broadly. You'll see for reasons. You'll see why as we get later. Okay, here's a set of other responses that they give you other ways out. So the response to Torah Lishma, which is, I forget who wrote it. Ben Yishchai, right? Which is we're 19th century Baghdad, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so his first, right? So he has a fun question where you have a father who asks a child to ride a hobby horse in public. and the question is, the parent says, I want you to ride a hobby horse in public. So the answer he gives is no. Why not? Because the obligation of kibbutz avim never requires you to prefer your parents' kavod to your own. Right? Just like you can prefer your lost object to your parents' lost object, so too you can prefer your kavod to your parents' kavod. Now, how does he deal with Doma ben Asina? Doesn't tell you. Right? But that's his halachic ruling, is you're allowed to say no. All right? I find it humiliating to ride a hobby horse in public. Then the Torah Lishma has an even more radical tshuva. I think one of the great all-time moves in responsible literature. Right? He says, what happens if, right, he reverses the situation, what happens if you have a father commanding a daughter not to marry? So he knows, as other people do, that, you know what, you can't pull the same argument for a daughter as a son, because the son has to get married. So he says, you're not just preventing me from marrying my number one choice, you're ordering me to marry my number two choice. But women have the option of not getting married. So apparently the pain of permanently remaining unmarried is less serious than the pain of marrying your number two choice. They say it.
I would attack the assumption.
I would attack the assumption too. But that is the assumption under which this tshuva works, right? There is when I taught this as a full course, I build it around a response to Rav Avadya Yosef, where he spends his time just, you know, burying that possibility that you can distinguish between men and women on this under many, many piles of achronim. But for now we're working in this universe. So the Torah Lishma takes the astonishing position, and one which I imagine if we took it halacha would elicit large rounds of boos in the crowd. Okay, says yes, your parents can tell you never to marry. Right? Parents are allowed to tell daughters, "I'm sorry, we need a spinster daughter to take care of us in our old age." Right? So that one can get married. That one can get married. You're going to stay home and be Cinderella. That's fine. And you know, if the trip ended there, right, it would be quite astonishing. But then he says, he says as an aside, he says, but what happens if she says to her parents, but I know myself, I'm not really capable of remaining celibate. So if you tell me to remain married, I will probably be promiscuous. Then, that's it. Just the claim, right? The claim of loss of self-control wins. Which I find just an astonishing move, right? You know, after going all that effort to build a halachic argument that he can tell her, that he just says, but by the way, all it takes is a claim, that you won't be able, right? So now, this is now we've moved Lifnei Iver, as opposed to Lifnei Iver, right? Lifnei Iver, you can't, right? So you had pointed out correctly, Lifnei Iver, it sounds like they shouldn't command you, but I have to listen. But now we have a self-declaration of Lifnei Iver. If I were to obey you, I would sin. Therefore, I don't have to obey you. Which is really a quite, quite radical move. Yes?
Why can't we just frame his understanding of Kibbutz as it, you know, it's a mitzvah, and you have to weigh it against other mitzvahs, and there's no real concern for personal comfort or happiness on the part of the child. But assuming that the parent wants is legitimate, meaning not the first case where it's ridiculous, but if there's a legitimate interest of the parents to having the child do what they want, the child needs to come up with a halachic counter argument in order not to do it.
But I point out that there is no case in which a child cannot come up with a legitimate halachic counter argument. Right? Because a moral objection is sufficient. A sense that it will cause you to sin is sufficient. A claim that it relates more directly to you than to your parents.
Not for the Ben Ish-Chai. For the Ben Ish-Chai, you need a halachic counter argument. Here it happens to be that it's a very clear halachic issue, but I don't know if you could say that in other cases you'd have that.
Okay, so it's fair to say what I am doing is I'm stringing together all the ways out that you can find in sources, and you might.
That way.
Right, pardon?
You want to put it that way.
Right, and you might think that these are mutually exclusive and we should carve out spaces.
I mean, at least from the two tshuvos that are here, I don't pretend to have seen more than that, that there seems to be a consistent approach. That doesn't necessarily line up with the broader one.
He says that I don't have to ride the hobby horse. Why?
Because that's not a legitimate interest on the part
of the family. Now we have to define legitimate. What tshuva do we have that defines legitimate? The Ma'arik. Everyone agrees the Ma'arik is the standard of legitimate. The only sort. Every tshuva will start for the Ma'arik.
I think that the Ben Ish-Chai in the second tshuva implicitly disagrees with the Ma'arik.
I don't know. I'm not. I think that he may just have an interesting sense of what relates more to people.
don't know if it's about relating to people. He's specifically bringing in halakhic considerations.
I don't need to argue that. You know, to me, I confess that I'm only bringing in. I don't want to cite precedents that think that parents can even in principle tell daughters not to marry. So I'm not. I'm only interested in Ben Ish Chayef because even he, who takes that extravagant position, at the end still finds a way out. I don't need to the Ben Ish Chayef's authority on the principle in general. Okay, it's good to get a question I didn't call on you for before. Okay, so what we have right now, I would suggest, is that at least possible to construct a halachic argument of kibud av v'ein, which the obligation towards parents essentially, in practice, vanishes. All right, that there is no command which cannot be resisted, other than, I guess, something like the command, please bring me food now, at such point that it does not cause you either physical pain to do it, or psychological pain, or infringe on your SAT studying time, which is career choices, whatever it may be. At this point, the Netziv comes up with another of these great all-time reversals. So Netziv is source number 15. And Netziv says, Nira, the Hadi Isa Biradea, the Chenim Av Mocha Beven Lisa Ez Isha Shech Potzba. So he says, the Shulchan Aruch codifies the position of the Marik that fathers cannot tell sons whom not to marry. He says, oh, you know what? That only means if the parents would not be humiliated by the child's marriage. But if the parent would be humiliated by the child's marriage, that doesn't apply. That doesn't apply at all. And he says, if you look at the Marik, he reverses the Marik. He says, the Marik says that parents only have a right to relate to things that relate to their physical pleasures. Well, you know what? What happens if the parents were counting on their daughter-in-law to cook well? Right? So you're going to marry somebody who doesn't cook well. That directly affects your parents if they eat in your house. Right? So according to the Marik, obviously your parents are allowed to tell you not to marry somebody who doesn't cook well. Then he goes further, right? And here's where he puts that pasuk back in. He says, therefore, right? If according to this reason, if the marriage of this woman relates to your parents' pleasure, then you would be obligated to marry the one they tell you to, and not the other one. And furthermore, obviously, he says it's forbidden to marry a woman who would degrade the parents, because that would be a violation of arur makle aviv v'imo. Really, until the Netziv, nobody had ever thought that pasuk had halachic significance. The Netziv invents a whole new category. Right? It's not just prohibited to actively diminish your parent, to actively disrespect your parents. It's forbidden to do things that diminish your parents' kavod. Not just obligation to provide them, but it's forbidden to diminish it, because of Rum Makle. Yes, Jonathan.
Okay. Even before we get to the Netziv,
yeah.
Aside for a second. Right, to string together all those kulos, right, internally within the sources. Forget lahalacha, like what we take lahalacha, but internally is going to be is just not going to be consistent. Meaning, the Maharik, right, despite his having expanded diminished the scope of kibud av v'ein, right, it's not fair to present him as saying, right, even any minor possible pain, because one could say if that were the case, well, bittul melacha causes pain, right? I'm losing a significant amount of money, but right, the Marik himself is working within precedent, right? He's working within, right? I don't have to pay, right? I don't have to lose, but I don't have to, right? But I do have to give up gain, right? So all one has to do within the Marik is say, it's true, I don't have to cause myself emotional anguish, but I can't, right? But I can't make an argument that, oh, but if I don't listen to my parents, right, it will make me happier. That's never a legitimate argument.
No, I have to claim that it would make me unhappy.
It would make you unhappy.
To listen.
Right.
Yes.
Right, and that, right, already, right, is going to limit the scope, right, because monetarily we know this is limited. And part of his argument is the combination of these sort of, right, is the combination of arguments, in addition to the fact that the tshuva is framed in a neder, right, in a neder tshuva, where he ends up osering anyways, right, so he's a little bit freer to make arguments, right?
I'm not so bothered. The Marik is cited by everyone subsequently.
True,
and his arguments are cited independently.
It's not cited to negate the existence of the distinction between, right, bittul melacha and, right, which is what, in theory, right? Yeah. The strongest presentation of these two votes would be. But obviously, right, they don't take these, right, no one actually realistically takes the strongest read of all these sources such that, right, even internally one would eliminate Kibbutz Av Ha'im.
I don't know, because if you really took the distinction between Bittul and money directly, you would say that, you know, so marrying a woman, right, not marrying a woman is Bittul Malacha, it's opportunity costs. I don't know any place where that claim, where Bittul Malacha...
Right, and he couldn't make that argument, right? He couldn't say that, right?
Because, but no one else does either. I don't know anywhere...
He makes the Avera point, right? He has to go in the direction of Avera point because he can't just argue that on the pure grounds that it would make me happier. He has to make the argument that I would be unhappy, right?
I think a purely theoretical issue. In practice, I don't think there's any circumstance in which you could... Right, you could come up with a compelling halakhic argument, you have to listen, in which somebody could not construct the claim either that the reason they wish to listen is that they think there is something wrong, or that there is some form of experience of pain they would experience.
Of course, but taking that to the extreme would be the impossible, which would be...
Okay, good, we'll leave,
I will leave you the one
case. Your parent says, I would like you to leave work 1 minute early today to fetch me a glass of water, which I will pay for. That is still an obligation. Right, now we have preserved the halakhic obligation of Kibbutz Av Ha'im, but we can go home. Most people can live with that, I think. Right, that's all I need. The Bittul Malacha standard just shows up nowhere in later responsa literature, so far as I know. And nobody tries to use that as the boundary, so far as I know. Or you can come with 100 tomorrow to disprove me. Or now, right, because we have Bar-Ilan here. Okay, what I wanted to put it is that the Netziv, though, does something much more radical than I just said. The Netziv, who I think probably was confronted by people like me giving shurim like this and got really mad. So the Netziv gets up and says, it's not just that people are abusing the Maharik to mean that parents can never tell children whom not to marry. That can't be true. Parents have to, right? Parents have a real right in that. The Netziv says, and by the way, when we said that you don't have to listen to your parents when they tell you to do something illegal, Let's be careful. He says, "We only learned that about the mitzvot aseh relative to parents. So when it's yirat or kavod, then you don't have to listen to your parents. But if we could get it into this new standard of arur makleh, where somehow you actually are actively causing disrespect to your parents, well, he says, maybe you should violate all the Torah to avoid disrespect to your parents. And all right. So now he has vitiated all these claims." Right, that your parents can explicitly tell you to violate the Torah, right? If in fact there is a counterclaim, by your parents, that not only do they want this for their kavod, but that they will legitimately feel their kavod diminished by your failure to obey. So now we have an extreme argument the other way. Now this argument itself is beautifully flipped by Rav Avadya Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef says, you know what? He has a really powerful argument. What do we do here? Avram told Yitzchak not to marry Canaanite women. Yitzchak told Yaakov not to marry Canaanite women. How on earth can anybody ever claim halachically that parents can't tell children whom not to marry? They weren't Jewish. Well, usually Avram and Yitzchak are a pretty good precedent, though. Right? Usually. You can make that argument, but it's kind of a desperation argument when you say, well, Avram and Yitzchak could only tell their relation, what they could tell their children to do is bounded by the... I gotta finish. Right? So, I think Rav Avadya does an amazing piece of what I call intellectual judo, and he says, aha, now we know what the standard is for the Netziv. Any parent who feels as humiliated by their child marrying somebody as Avram would have felt to have Yitzchak marry a Canaanite is entitled to object. But if you don't reach that standard, then you haven't hit the prohibition of a Rurmak Levi Vimo. And so this is completely read out of halacha again. I think if Rav Avadya is making this move, I might be reading it into him, but if he is, I think it's a beautiful move. Okay, where does this end up? So what I want to suggest is the following. That Kibbutz Av Ha'im is not, first of all, Kibbutz Av Ha'im is generally not an enforceable law, halachically. So we talk about what the law is, we're talking about a question not of what the police should make you do, but we're talking about the question of how you construct internally your own sense of what you are obligated to do, or alternatively, depending on how you make such decisions, what your rabbi should tell you if you ask him what you ought to do, or if you ask him what you have to do. Where I think you end up, halachically, if you put all this together, is that on the one hand, you have a very powerful rhetoric about how far you could go without and still be fulfilling the mitzvah as opposed to being insane. Right, and the default setting is that children should be dan lekaf schut, that parental requests are reasonable, and you can construct obligations that go very, very far. On the other hand, there is, I think, a general sense in halacha that creating an obligation of one person towards another always runs the risk of giving the second person way too much power over the first. And so you always have to find a way of preventing religious power from generating abuse. And so the simple metaphor for that is lifnei iver, right? To say that every time I have an obligation towards you, you have an obligation to help me fulfill that obligation. And secondly, that the rabbis are fully aware that giving people power is in a sense a violation of lifnei iver always. And whenever you have power over somebody, right, it generates the temptation to abuse that power. So you build in, right? So you build in ways out so that if the halakha is ever used as a justification of abuse, I gave this shiur on Shavuos, and somebody came up to me and told me that it was liberating because he'd been abused by his father for 25 years, and every time he tried to fight back, his father would yell at him, "Kibud av v'aim," and his father was a great Talmud Chacham, so he couldn't. So he didn't feel that he could resist. So I want to very explicitly draw the boundary against that and to say that halacha, and I think this is a general thesis in halacha, that when it gives one person power over another, it always builds in a way that power cannot turn into abuse. So we have is a whole set of arguments that if somebody tries to use the law, such as, for example, we try and draw a line between opportunity costs and actual expenses. But we all know that saying that you can demand time but not money is not a sustainable distinction in practice, because you can demand time to the point, right, the point where everything else in life becomes impossible. So what I want to suggest here is that halacha sets it up deliberately as a dialectic, that it is possible in a healthy relationship to construct for yourself an obligation that goes very far, and to correctly tell yourself that by going that far, you are fulfilling the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim. But it also builds in the capacity to defend yourself, so that if it really is not a healthy relationship, that you have the capacity to say no, right? I don't have to construct halacha that way. Now, in one kind of community, or some circumstances, that balance inheres in the posek whom you ask questions to. In other types of communities and circumstances, that balance inheres in every person. But the overall thesis I want to set out is that we would never in halacha set out an obligation of absolute obedience, because that would be bad for both parties. It would be bad, right? The party who owes obedience, right, might be forced to destroy themselves, and the party who has the capacity to exact that kind of obedience will end up abusing it. So I want to set out kibud av v'aim as a model for the way in which halacha always balances the power it grants. And in practice, what it means is that, of course, children should seek to, in a healthy relationship, children should seek to expand the boundaries of kibud av v'aim and seek to find the ways in which they can express it as far as possible. But they also have the right to recognize what is healthy and what is unhealthy. And all the healthy relationship, halacha leaves you enough space to define it so that you could end up saying that at most the obligation is to fetch the one glass of water at the end of the workday and charge for your gas in the process. All right, thank you very much.